Howdy there, friends, and thanks for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale, and as always, my amigo today, Mr. Kyle Filio Filson.
How's it going, everybody?
As you can tell, we are missing one who we said would be here, Micah Hanks. Micah is here, except he's in Aurora, Texas right now with Joshua Cutchin and Red Pill Junkie. And Greg Bishop, Tim Banal, there's a whole bunch of them in Aurora. So we're knocking this show out right quick, as quick as possible that we can do it. You know how we like to drone on. And then we're all going to go meet up with them. Now, earlier in the week, I was at work. Kyle already got to run around with them over in Dealey Plaza. They got to run around and play over there, check out all the Kennedy assassination stuff. So we're going to monk around with that. But we're having a great day. We survived all the storms earlier in the week. I mean, so everything's good. Me and Kyle have been busy. Weather's awesome now. We've got a really interesting show. But Kyle, let's jump into this, man. You were telling me something that you wanted to discuss with me that you was like, look, I got to tell you something real quick, but hold on. Turn on the mics. Yeah. I got to tell you.
Yeah. Well, you know how we keep up with Warren and Waz and Chris and those guys, Bill Flowers down there at the Thylacine Research Unit. And I'm very interested in these thylacine sightings. And they just had another one, another Tasmanian tiger sighting. It was actually reported in South Gippsland. It was pretty cool. Now, they said after a Venus Bay caravan park owner, Tony Holgate, spotted the tiger at the park back in December.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Right? We got a bunch of emails about that.
Barry Murphy also reported a sighting, they say, in a place called Inverloch recently. They said the Inverloch resident said he was positive he caught a glimpse of the nocturnal marsupial and added jokingly that he had just one glass of wine for the night. He said he was driving along Ullathorne Road when it crossed the road in front of him. And he said as it drove by, he saw that it had stripes down its side and onto its flank. He said, I thought to myself, I have seen something exceptional here. So I turned around and went back. And of course, when I went back, it had disappeared. So this is two recent sightings we've had within the last 3 or 4 months mm-hmm. of a Tassie tiger or a thylacine in the same area. So, I mean,
Waz and Chris and them will be on it. Bill, they'll be down there.
I need to talk to them and see what they think. But I mean, you know, whenever this happens, you know, multiple people seeing the Tassie tiger, it makes me believe that there's one there.
I should ask Waz about it because I was talking to Waz over the weekend. We were talking about the Polaris Pro Jiu-Jitsu tournament. And we was watching at the sub-only tournament. And he was watching. I was watching it. And then I know Jesse from White Belt Survival was watching it. We were all going back and forth and talking all kinds of jiu-jitsu. So we got caught up. I should have asked him about that. Yeah. I think I'll get in touch with him and find out what he thinks about that whole deal.
Pretty cool. But keeping with cryptozoology, did you see this over here at Cryptozoology News? They said a man in southeastern Tennessee claims that three people saw a white and hairy bipedal creature. Now, Carrie, who's a Flintville resident, said that events took place near Belvedere, Tennessee, and the creature was running through a cornfield in Franklin County.
A white walker.
A white one, right? He says, my sister and cousin are checking out my sister's new car.
Oh, I thought they would mean like they were one and the same.
Right? And he said it was back in 1997, and it was 9 p.m., and my sister and my cousin decided to test the car. Now, as they drove the vehicle, they noticed a white-shaped thing stepping out of the cornfield about 30 yards away. It said that the car had bright lights on, and we were able to see this creature crossing the road and into the darkness beyond the fence. Both came home talking fast, and they looked scared. Now, my younger cousin kept saying that he had seen a monster. Now, according to Carrie, the motorist described the animal as 8 feet tall, white, and hairy, walking on two legs. They said that its head was shaped like a cone or conical. Now, Carrie said that that wouldn't be the last time the white bipedal creature showed up. Just a few days later, his brother encountered something similar on the inside of their property. He said he heard the dogs going crazy outside, and he figured someone was messing around the house. So, of course, he went out the back door and turned the light on. He said when he went to the back of the house, he went inside and retrieved his weapon, and the creature purportedly made an appearance. He says, as I walked into the kitchen, he said he saw a white, large figure cross right by my glass door. It unnerved me when he noticed that the dogs were following something by the edge of the woods. Now, he also added that a few years earlier, his brother reported seeing a white face with red eyes staring at him from behind some trees. Now, that's pretty creepy, right? Now, this is not the first time I've ever heard of people seeing, as silly as it sounds, a white Bigfoot, right? There was another story. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. Where it was kind of like almost not, I guess a residential area.
Yep, I remember that. It was back. They actually even did a little reenactment on finding Bigfoot one time.
Oh, did they?
They talked about it, yes.
Yeah, I don't remember exactly what it was.
I want to say it was Rhode Island. Yep. I want to say that was the one sighting in Rhode Island that was a white Bigfoot.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. I think it was like Connecticut, Rhode Island, something like that. New England, definitely. Pretty cool.
I've got something we've been sticking with, and we've kind of been keeping our finger on the pulse, if you will. I mean, we're horrible at that, but we've been kind of paying attention to this. And folks, I want you to listen to this as what's being said, because I can't make out. I just want everybody's opinion, see what they think, and think about this for yourself. I can't make out if this story is a story that's really going on, or if this is an active, the conspiracy side of me, as if some sort of active cover-up. This come out on Live Science, and we've talked about this the last few weeks, about the hidden King Tut chambers.
Yeah, right.
The scans, okay?
Uh-huh.
Well, now
the Japanese guy had done some scans or something.
Well, now listen to this. It says that they're saying officials are cautioning not so fast. Now, there's a new antiquities minister, Khalid El Nanani, and he said in a press conference that they should really use some caution over this whole thing. Well, you look into it. You're right. Last year, there was some Japanese radar technologist, Watanabe. Now, Watanabe, you know, did all these scans and looked into all this and said, you know, that they had found this stuff. Well, I guess it was at the time there was a Ministry of Antiquities named Mamoudi El Damati. And he talked about Watanabe's scans. And he said this, suggests the presence of two empty spaces or cavities beyond the decorated north and west walls. Now, you have discussed that, of the burial chamber. And also, he said that those scans suggested the presence of metallic and organic substances. So that got everybody fired up.
Yeah, treasure, right? They thought there was treasure.
Exactly, that there's something in there. Well, this is what they're saying.
They
had some radar experts that were not affiliated with this project come in, and they started disputing these scans. And they noted this, that the sediment layers at the Valley of the Kings, where King Tut's tomb is located, contain natural voids and rock inclusions that make it difficult for radar to distinguish between them. So they don't know if it's like an archaeological remain or if it's a natural phenomenon. That's kind of what they're saying. So over the past few weeks, the Antiquities Minister that we just talked about, El Damati, him along with the Minister of Tourism there in Egypt, Hisham Zazu, were replaced in a cabinet shuffle. Yeah, that's right. Replaced. And a team supported by the National Geographic Society conducted new radar scans. And those scans are being processed and analyzed. But the new Antiquities Minister, El Anani, still sounded this. He says this note of caution. We are not looking for hidden chambers, but for the reality of the truth. We are very keen to follow the scientific procedures. Now, instantly, when I read this, I'm like, well, why would you replace? Like, I know there's corruption and they've had problems with it in the past. We know that about Egypt and the antiquities over there. And it's a chess game of who's in control and who's power and all that, the whole deal. But this also almost feels like, do they know something's there and they're going to brush it off as we didn't find anything but a natural cavity? And then quietly and secretively, they themselves are going to go look for it?
Probably, right? I could see them selling them in the black market to make money.
Yeah, well, that's...
Who knows?
Exactly. I don't know.
Or
I don't know what they're going
to
do.
Or is nothing really there, and they're creating this to try to, you know, bolster tourism.
Tourism to get them in. You know, I know exactly what you're saying.
Draw more tourists that way. Because, you know, ever since a lot of the unrest in that area, I think I read that tourism is really down.
The cool thing is this. As Damati says this in a press conference, he said, you know, was talking about the two cavities that could exist. He said, we have to be 100% sure. And he also says that the preliminary results of yesterday's scan, speaking of the ones that they had done by National Geographic, reached so far, do not contradict with the results of the previous radar scans. So what they're saying now is maybe they are right. So I don't know how to feel about this whole thing at all. It feels weird. It feels strange. We don't really know, you know, if it's being pulled, like you said, is it being used to try to bring tourism? Is it really there? Are they going to cover it up? I don't know. But it does seem like when National Geographic gets involved, it seems like it'd be hard to cover up. I don't know enough about them. You know, I know I'm speaking out of turn, but I don't know enough about National Geographic. But it would seem like that society gets involved, it would be hard to do a cover up. So maybe we are going to finally get to the bottom of this. It seems like this is more red tape, too. Like, oh, they found it. Let's go look. No. Let's make sure we're 100% sure and all this stuff. It seems, you know what I mean? Like they're kind of muddy in the waters to try to slow them down to maybe like you said, maybe they themselves want to go in there and look first.
Or maybe they're just taking their time. I mean, look how long it's taken them to excavate, you know, Göbekli Tepe.
Exactly.
They've been working on it for 20 years and they've only uncovered like 1%.
Yeah. You're right. Maybe they are just taking their
You know
time.
What I mean? I've talked about it on the show before. I'm like, well, come on, keep digging. What is it taking so long
exactly.
for? Hurry
exactly.
up.
Exactly. Let's get
I'd like
there.
To see it before I'm dead.
Right. Yeah, I'd like to read about it while I can still see.
Yeah, well, moving on from archaeology, let's move over to Open Minds TV, where a new rectangle UFO was noticed hovering over Georgia. And the witness says that it blocked out the stars. Now, check this out. The witness was walking outside, talking on his cell phone, around 2:15 a.m. on November 4th, 2013, on a clear night with good weather. Something unusual was noticed in the night sky. I noticed first off the fact that I could not see any stars in the area. The fact that I could see some stars, but in an area I could not see any. It didn't seem right to me at all. It says that the witness was puzzled as to why some of the sky was blocked from seeing the stars. I don't think that at that moment I was looking at anything. I kept looking and then I realized when the end of the area was then allowing me to see stars. At that moment I realized something was in front of me and that it was very large. I could then see the size due to the area that I could not see. Now, it says at this point that the witness was very close to the object. It was black, but not shiny, but not necessarily a dull surface either. It was approximately 3 stories tall, approximately 300 feet long, and roughly 75 feet wide. It traveled from north to south, and I saw the entire west side of the craft. I did not see the front of it at all. I could see that part of the back end, but it was limited due to the dark color of the craft and the fact that it was nighttime. I did not notice the bottom of the craft until it was a light blue, white, or white, light blue. It was a softer, normal. It was softer than a normal LED light. The light appeared to run the width of the craft. The height of the bottom of the craft to the ground was approximately 15 feet above the trees. I did notice that the trees didn't move at all. And when I realized that there was a large craft not very far from me, I did not want to move. I didn't know what this thing was, and I didn't want it to see me. I didn't understand what I was seeing. It didn't make any sense that it could even be moving. It looked heavy, and not a way to... It didn't appear that there was any way for this thing to stay in the air. It had no wings. It had no sound. It was just there. It was moving at approximately 2 miles an hour and continued south until I couldn't see it any longer. I did not want to follow the craft down the road. You know, it says again, I did not want the craft to notice me. And I figured that the faster it would leave, the better it would be for me. So it sounds like a big black rectangle with a light blue light on it, like a PlayStation 4.
Yeah, right. Flying through the air.
That's what I'm picturing, right? My PlayStation 4 is hovering.
That's not cool.
No, I wouldn't want it to see me either. Yeah, very, very interesting.
Well, and just like that, how do you mistake in a box flying in the air?
Well, that's what I like. He's like, said he was just talking on his cell phone, looking up. He's like, man, why can't I see any stars? And then I can see some over here. He didn't, you know, quite understand what he was seeing. And then when he finally saw, oh, whoa, that's something in the air.
That was a glitch in the hologram.
Yeah.
It was a glitch in the matrix. But you know what I mean? It's one thing to misidentify things. How do you misidentify a flying box? You don't. They're not made to fly.
Right.
Well, I've got you something here that's pretty interesting. This comes from Ancient Origins, and I am going to kind of bring it back around a little more archaeology. Mark Miller over there posted this. As evidence for Vikings in Canada grows with surprising find of iron working site in Newfoundland.
Yeah, I saw this.
I'm so excited.
Adam K. Olson sent me a link over the weekend. Yeah, very cool, man. Dude,
this is awesome. That says that experts are cautiously optimistic. Now, this is National Geographic talking about that they found a hearth where people worked iron about 1,000 years ago in Newfoundland. Now, the site is Point Rose, and I guess it's Rose with two E's. I'm not sure. It's French-Canadian. And they said this is the second where there's strong evidence of Viking settlements in the New World, it says here. Now, the first, I'm not going to butcher the beautiful language that is French-Canadian, but the last word is meadows. I'll just put you that. So the first is something meadows here, and it's also there in Newfoundland, about 100 miles north of Point Rose, and it was discovered in 1960. Well, they say the hearth at Point Rose is surrounded by the remnants of rectangular turf walls. That's kind of how they found it. And that in this area that they found this depression that was a hearth. And in the hearth, they found, get a load of this, 28 pounds of slag. Now, that slag's a byproduct of working with iron.
Right, yeah.
Now, the scholars do not believe natives of this area in the 11th century were working with iron, though there was metalworking in the New World before, of course, the Europeans arrived. Now, what's cool is the person that kind of ushered this site in is Sarah Parkick. Now, she's working with a $1 million TED Prize, all right? And mm-hmm. what she's known as is space archaeologist. Now, she used the satellite imagery to find evidence of human activity in the landscape. That's what she does. Now, usually, Sarah studies this satellite imagery of Egypt and finds these ancient trade routes, goes through all, which is a new way of studying the world. That think of how much time it saves everybody. You know, you're talking about studying things like that. So she decided, you know what, I'll look at some other places. Well, there at Point Rose, she says that she saw a faint difference in the vegetation, and that vegetation somehow formed a rectangle. And that's when she's like, wait a second. So they got to looking around in there. Now, it has like bog iron, natural deposits of metal around there, where they know that the Vikings would have seen, and they kind of moved into this whole area. There's all kinds of stuff. Now, Sarah told the Washington Post that absolutely confirms that the site is Norse. But she goes on, so she's not saying she's on. It is a site. There is metalworking going on there, but we don't know who did it.
Yeah, that's
she
cool,
said this,
man.
Though, that it's going to take years of careful excavation, years, much like what we were just talking about, and it's going to be controversial. It raises a lot more questions than it answers, but that's what any new discovery is supposed to do. And she's right. Now, I do love the idea of that. Now, there's an archaeologist, an expert in Viking settlements named Doug Bolander, and he told National Geographic this. The sagas suggest a short period of activity and a very brief and failed colonization attempt. Meadows fits well with the story, but is only one side. Point Rose could reinforce that story or completely change it if the dating is different from Meadows. We could end up with a much longer period of Norse activity in the New World. A site like Point Rose has the potential to reveal what that initial wave of North colonization looked like, not only for Newfoundland, but for the rest of the North Atlantic.
That's pretty cool. I mean, this is Vinland. Mm-hmm. That's where we're living, right?
That's what they're talking about is, like we've discussed, there's all these dabbles where they've like, oh, there's just a little bit of stuff here, a little bit of stuff there. And if you take like I guess you could almost say like a group of people that show up and they didn't stay in one area long, you know, they migrate and they move and all that stuff. It sounds like they're finding these North villages now, though, that may have put up roots a little bit longer than what we initially believed.
Yeah, if they're finding all this metalworking, I mean, they had a camp or a village or something set up there.
Well, that's what he's saying is it's one of two things are going to happen. Either it's going to completely validate what we've already believed is what we think we found now, or it's going to wipe that away and make us reroute and look all over again.
There's no doubt in my mind. I mean, there's several sites all over the United States where there's these rune carvings.
Yeah.
That's in their
Well, when is that going to lead to that? You know, when are they going to take the next step? Because if they find this, and this reinforces it all, and in the next few years they say, okay, this reinforced what we initially believed, Norse activity has been here often. There's a lot of it. Well, when are they going to step out and go, you know what, all the stuff that we thought was hoaxed and we tried to brush away in the, you know, the turn of the century up until, you know, the 50s or whatnot that we tried to wipe away of these stones, that's probably real.
Well, like there's still people that think that the Kensington runestone is faked by the farmers that found it.
Yeah.
And how ridiculous is that?
Well, that they didn't find out about the language that was carved on it, the hooked X, until within the last 20 years.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
It is.
Well, that's pretty interesting. I love those kind of stories. Well, stick with us, folks. We're going to take a break. And when we get back from the break, Cam's got a very interesting story about the Coral Castle. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives. And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Cam's got a very interesting story, and I love this story. It's something that's intrigued me for numerous years. I remember I was a teenager, and one of my uncles, one of my favorite uncles, told me the story of this Edward Lee Scowlin. And I remember at first, I was like, what is he talking about? And of course, this was before the internet, and you'd have to go to the encyclopedia.
It wasn't easy to find.
Or I remember one time I was in a library, and it was like some kind of book of astonishing mysteries or something. I don't remember what the book was. But it had these pictures, And then when you start reading these stories and you're like, I'm picturing this old, frail, tiny, tiny man who somehow has this unknown knowledge that he learned from the ancients, and he's levitating these rocks and stones and creating this, you know, that they say no one else could create. So I was always intrigued with this story. So I'm glad that you're going to bring it up today, because it is mysterious. On one hand, there's people that say it's super mysterious, and on the other hand, they say, no, it's not as mysterious. So I'm interesting to hear what you've dug up.
Well, it's one of those things, yeah, if you're looking for it to be the woo-woo factor of floating stones and of magic and this magical box on top of, on top of a tripod and all that stuff, I'm going to probably disappoint you.
Oh, so it's true then. It's blown up to be way more than it is.
I think it is. This is going to be, I'm going to give you all the stuff that I could find about it and let everybody, of course, like what we love to do, everybody make up their own mind. But I think there's more, it's almost more to the man than it is the Coral Castle. To me, the Coral Castle, the man himself is what this story should really be about, Ed Lee Scanlon. Now, I'm going to read you an outtake from a book called Atlantis Rising by our friend Christopher Dunn. And in there, he talks about the incredible mystery of the Coral Castle. And I'm going to lay this out. And I want you to listen to this, because this kind of puts it, I guess you could say, in the right mindset whenever you listen. Now, listen to this here. He says that my company recently installed a hydraulic press that weighed 65 tons. In order to lift it and drop it through the roof, they had to bring in a special crane. The crane was brought to the site in pieces and was transported from 80 miles away over a period of 5 days. After 15 semi-trailer loads, the crane was finally assembled and ready for use. As the press was lowered into its specialty prepared pit, I asked one of the riggers about the heaviest weight he had lifted. He claimed that it was a 110-ton nuclear power plant vessel. When I related to him that the 70 and 200-ton weights of the blocks of stone used inside the Great Pyramid and the Valley Temple, he expressed amazement and disbelief that the primitive methods that are promoted by Egyptologists. For many, it is enough just to argue this issue from a logical standpoint. For others, the subject becomes more meaningful when a proposed method is demonstrated and proven to be successful. There is only one man in the world who, by demonstration, has supported the claim. I know the secret of how the pyramids of Egypt were built. The man is now deceased. The claim was made by an eccentric Latvian recluse named Edward Leeds Scanlon, an immigrant to the United States of America. He devised a means to single-handedly lift and maneuver blocks of coral weighing up to 30 tons each.
Mm.
Now get a load of that. That's the whole thing. So he knows he had a 65-ton compressor they had to use. Hydraulic press, let's say. And they lowered it into place with a crane. It took them 5 days to bring all that stuff together and put it all together. And Ed was doing this stuff basically in the privacy of his own
little
area.
That's what makes it mysterious. That's
by
why
himself.
There's some supernatural power that he was aware of that nobody else knew. And he always heard the stories that he knew what the ancient Egyptians knew. And that's how they were able to construct
the
pyramid. So very interesting, right?
That's the things that he used to claim. Now, we're going to talk about Ed. Like I said, the Coral Castle is very neat. Now, we just start discussing things in the castle. There's several things in that area there. There's supposed to be an obelisk. That's a 22-ton obelisk. There's supposed to be a block they call the moon block, 22-ton moon block, 23-ton Jupiter block. There's like a 9-ton gate. There was rocking chairs that he had made and puzzle pieces that he had made that weighed 3 tons. They were just coral blocks of the castle walls that were 15 tons apiece. There was even a 30-ton block that crowned a gable-shaped rock that he had like set up on top of another. There was tons of stuff that he, pardon the pun, that he would constantly was doing that nobody could figure out, that he worked on and worked on. Now, you got to picture this. Now, Edward was a very small man. Now, he was born in 1887. He was Latvian. He left school around the fourth grade, end of the third, first of the fourth. He left, went to work. Of course, you're talking about, you know, we're talking the early 1900s, turn of the century. That in Latvia, it probably wasn't a big deal. A lot of people did that, had to go back to work. When he was 28 years old, the story goes that he became engaged to a woman named Agnes Scuffs, and that they were to be married. All right. Now, she was 16 years old at the time.
Mm.
He had fallen in love with her, and he had always called even his books Sweet 16. And that's apparently was the story that it went. The story also goes that the day before their wedding, Agnes told Ed straight up that he was too poor and too old for her to marry him. Said, you don't make enough money and you're too old.
Ouch.
Which I'm sure would crush anybody, you know, yeah. after you've fallen in love the whole deal. Maybe he was a creeper. Who knows? It goes the fact on. It takes another step that Ed was destroyed, heart broke and crushed. So what does he do? He takes what he's got and he leaves Latvia. He comes to America to find a new life, basically. The story goes that he goes through Canada. He does some logging work. He, you know, makes his way all down through the states, goes into California. They even say that he arrived in East Texas and worked over here in East Texas some too. Before finally, around 1820, he finds his way into southern Florida. Now, you got a picture of fella that's like 5'1", maybe 5', depending on the boots that he's wearing, and weighs 100 pounds. Now, you got to picture him working on cattle drives, lumber camps. He's a little frail fella. So you have to imagine he got ribbed a lot. There was a lot of bullying, I'm sure, went on. And also probably not being able to speak perfectly clear, you know, English and having a pretty thick accent. The guys, you know, local guys probably give him a really hard time. Also being a small fella too, and all that, maybe it was his health. Maybe it wasn't just his breeding or whatnot. Maybe it was his health that caused him to be like that, because he did develop tuberculosis. And that's the reason that he says that he chose Florida, because he thought that it would be a really good area for him to live in. It was very sunny. Of course, you know, we always hear the stories like with Doc Holliday. He was told to go to, you know, to like Nevada. And go out in New Mexico and anywhere there was dry areas. Florida's real humid, so you would think it would go exactly the opposite of that. But anyway, that's where Ed ended up going. He moved to a town called Florida City, which is just southwest of Miami. Not very far, less than 30 miles. And that's where he said that he decided he would build his coral castle as a tribute to his lost love. Now, the site started opened up to the public as a tourist attraction for Ed to make some money in 1923. Now, it took 20 years to complete most of it, of what you see today. Now, he supported himself. When I say supported himself, paid for the land, for tools, and all these other items. Nobody really, really knows. You know, they say that he did some odd jobs here and there. I've heard stories of that he knew about ley lines and he knew about magnetic lines and that he had metal in his shoes and that he would walk in certain areas. They also said that he would take a bicycle. And I've heard him talk about he would take the tires off and it would just be metal rims and he could ride the metal rims of a bicycle around and find these magnetic ley lines like he was almost in tuned for it. Now, there's a lot of stuff that goes on to say that he maybe had done some odd jobs and all that stuff, but that they really weren't sure where he got a lot of his money. Then there's also some things that you can read that says that that he had made some investments in like some utility stuff. Like he had saved money as he moved down and he made some investments in utility departments there in Florida. So he was getting payment off those investments that he had made. There's also another source for the story that says that a neighbor let him build the original castle on borrowed property there in Florida City. And then there was another one says that he bought an acre there. And there's, like I said, there's tons of these different little parts of these stories. Goes on that he'd saved, like I said, enough of his money as he worked his way down there, because through the stories that you read, he walked everywhere or he rode a bicycle. I mean, even up until his dying days, I don't think he owned a vehicle. So everywhere he went as he traveled, he was either public transportation or he walked. So Ed doesn't sound like he spent a lot of money. And then if you grew up in a harsh time like Ed probably did, you can imagine that he was hanging on to every coin that he had. He wasn't really going to do a lot with it till he found the right spot. And when I say the right spot is, it's speculated that Ed picked an area there to build it on because of these magnetic ley lines. Now, I talk about that because Ed wrote 5 books. People call them pamphlets. You can find them, whatever you want. 3 of those are actually about magnetic current. Now, he titled one of them, Mineral, Vegetable, and Animal Life. Is what one of them's called, and it contains what Ed believed about the life cycles of the world. Another one's called A Book in Every Home, and it was his thought about domestic and political views, as well as his ex-girlfriend. Now, he wrote several of these things, but the magnetic current are very, very interesting, because to find the original writings, it is said that you can learn Ed's secrets in the original writings, not the ones that have been rewritten. Like you can go on Amazon, stuff like that, and you can find these Kindle versions. No, because it was supposed to be the secret of his, what he knew how to do was in the typos and in the pronunciation of words, the way he had written them out, the way they sounded. There were certain misspellings, lots of things that he had done that they believe was a hidden code in those pamphlets.
Really?
And that's how that you, yes, that's how that you would be able to figure out what he did. Also, too, people would give him money. He would get a load of this now. The tours of the castle, when he finished it, you could go take a tour of it for a dime or a quarter per person. So you'd go in there and give him a quarter, you'd take a tour, even a dime. That's what it is. And people believe that that's where most of his money came from. So much so that in the 1930s, it was a group of thugs that they call it in the writing, thugs,
right,
unsavory characters, thought that Ed had tons of money, and
really,
that it was all hidden in there. So they show up, beat him up, and they rob him. Well, they don't get much of anything because Ed doesn't have much of anything.
Right.
So.
It wasn't originally named Coral Castle, right? Wasn't it called something else?
Yeah.
I think Rock Gate.
It was Rock Gate Park or Rock.
Yeah.
Exactly was what it was supposed to be. The Coral Castle thing didn't come in until after Ed, I believe, had passed away.
Right. That's what I thought it was.
Because he had passed away. He gave it to a nephew. And then as the nephew passed away, or before he passed away, he sold it to a couple there in Florida as it changed. But this also wasn't the original spot. Where it is now is the second chosen spot to Coral Castle. When Ed got his ass kicked and he realized that the world was kind of encroaching on him, he decided, you know what? I'm going to move it. So he picked up everything. Everything that he had already built up to the 30-ton stuff and moved it 10 miles away to where it's at now near Homestead, Florida.
Huh.
Now, the crazy thing is he hired a local truck driver, and that the driver would pull up and leave the trailer. Now, you hear some different stories. It first started off as this. Leave the trailer, come back tomorrow. The driver would come back, the trailer would be loaded, he would take it and drive it, come back, drop the truck off, come back tomorrow. He would come back, it would be unloaded, they would go back and get more. He never let the driver see what he was doing. Now, they say there was about 3 million pounds of hard coral total was what he moved around up there. But also, too, in one of the other stories I found this, that in 1936, since Ed was making his money, like I said, there's a lot of conjecture to this story, which is what's crazy. If you can't feel where I'm going with this, folks, it sounds like it was a story of a man that understood physics, and people blew the story up, really made it into something more romantic than what it was.
Right.
Because
that's what I always heard was unknown secret energies he was aware of, or alien technology.
Now, he may have been aware of some of that. We're not saying that, but just like this. First, I hear in the 30s that people beat him up and took his money. Well, then I find that it was also believed in the late 30s that Ed had learned that they were planning to build a subdivision all around Coral Castle. And he didn't want that. He didn't want anybody moving in next to him. So he packed it up and moved it.
I gotcha.
Now, what they don't tell you is this. It took him about 3 years to move the castle. It's not like it happened in a week. There's different stories about that, too. Some people say it took him a few months. Other people say, but they say it took over the next 3 years of when he decided to move. That's about how long it took him to move the 10 miles. And he had bought 10 acres out there in the country and completely reconstructed the entire thing. Now, some people say that it was 3 miles north of Homestead. Anyway, everything states though that it was moved about 10 miles away and that he left one tower away. And there's even some of them says he did it in less than a month. The thing is this, is you can't really find a lot on when it was, because I don't think they were like a building permit. It wasn't, you know, it was, I bought some land and I built, stacked some rocks on it. There's really like, okay, you need to do this. Okay, you need to do that. Today, the Coral Castle occupies 3 of the original 10 acres. That's what they know. They know that that's been found in the whole thing. Now, like I told you, they say he didn't own a car, that everywhere he went, he had a bicycle. And he was about 3.5 miles from the store, and he would ride in the town for supplies and all that. But they did say he owned the chassis of an old pickup, and it was just a rectangular steel frame supported on springs and then attached to axles. And that was it. And then it holds the body and the motor, of course, of the whole deal, but that's all it was. And that Ed laid 2 rails on his truck chassis to hold blocks, and then would ask the friends with tractors to tow this, what he called a trailer, to Homestead. So they're saying now that he even built his own trailer, that maybe there wasn't a real driver, is what I found away. So we don't really know what's going on here. You follow me?
Yeah.
You're getting stories to where there's a driver was there. Now there's not a driver. Now Ed's got his own. He took a motor and didn't even have a motor, just took a chassis, put rails on it, would stack blocks on it, and they would just tow it down the road.
Yeah.
So you don't, there's so much, and look, You can go to the Coral Castle. You can go see it today. You can get videos. You can go online and look at it. The problem is this, is even that doesn't explain what they found. You know, none of that stuff. So it's crazy because I think even the Coral Castle doesn't know the true story. Because the thing that happened is...
The small, little, tiny Latvian man using only hand tools.
Hand tools, exactly.
Was able to move the and create these blocks and move them around and stuff. It is bizarre. I mean, and there's one that's like a door, perfectly balanced.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, how was he able to, and he always seemed to do this stuff overnight, right? Like little kids would say they would see him, you know, setting up stuff,
well,
but they wouldn't begin the stories at night.
That's the stories. Well, the reason I say it's so hard to find and figure out anything is because in 1952, Ed wasn't feeling well. So Ed goes to the hospital, checks himself into the hospital. A couple of days later, he's dead. That's it. No known relatives in the... you know what I mean? Find he's got a nephew states away. But as far as like leaving anything and teaching anybody, nobody knows. So that's what I'm saying is nobody really knows besides hearsay of, did Ed get beat up? Did Ed hear about a subdivision? Did Ed have his own chassis? Did Ed hire a driver? What did Ed do for a living? Can Ed find... Nobody really knows. There's too much that's been lost to history. So that's what's so crazy, I guess, about this story, before we even get into what he was capable of building. Now, when we talk about these sizes of these things, he lived there in the castle, in these areas. So he's built some rooms and things. And if you go and look, there's like some crazy electric motors that look like he has. And he's got copper wires strolled out across the top.
Yeah, right.
You know, that like go crisscross across the area. I do know that there's some blocks that weigh like 4 to 9 tons in this one tower. Around it, there's also these monoliths that are like 2 stories tall. There's also an obelisk that's like 40 foot tall that's supposed to be stuck in the ground there that weighs 28 tons. And there's like he's carved like some stars on some stuff in there. A lot of it is laid out. They say that the shaft of the obelisk is actually about 5 foot in the ground. Now, there's another structure there, and near the top of it is what Ed called the Polaris telescope. And of course, they say that this Polaris telescope weighs about 40,000 pounds and that you can look through it because he's cut it to where you can look through and see certain planets, certain stars, all these things. He even says that, you know, I forgot there's a name of another one. It's the same deal, but he's got one of all around these crossed wires. He's got one that where the North Star, you can see aligns with these cross wires that he's got coming out of this certain obelisk. And he even in the 1940s carved into one side of this rock telescope on one part of it where you could see somewhere, I guess, where it would help to point more towards it where people could see it. So the craziest thing about this, too, is there's sculptures in the yard that represent Mars and Saturn and all these other, you know, planets and things around there. And they lay out just kind of like what you would see in Mexico when they lay out around these temples. He's built all that also. So he's knows a not only, you know, what's going on, but how to set them all up to meet certain parts of the solar cycles and things also, too, that's in that area.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
So he went above and beyond with carving all this stuff, but it all comes down into like this. There's sundials there, you know, that's supposed to have these, you know, adjustments for leap year. And I mean, he's got all this stuff cut down and cut out, and it's wild the things that he's cut, the dimensions of stuff. Like they said, that there's a website on there, the one website of the Coral Castle says that there's blocks that weigh more than 58 tons. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it says that there are blocks there that weigh more than 58 tons and that the average limestone block there in the Coral Castle weighs 6 tons. And they say that's twice as heavy as the average block in the Great Pyramid. And Ed was moving it, just moving it around like it was nothing.
Yeah.
Now, I'm going to tell you this. This comes from the Coral Castle's website. It says that coral weighs approximately 125 pounds per cubic foot, and that each section of the castle wall is 8 foot tall, 4 feet wide, and 3 feet thick. So that would weigh approximately 13,000 pounds.
Yeah. So how was he able to move that stuff around?
That's nobody. Look,
I mean, you know?
Yeah. It's crazy to even think about the ability. Now, I have read this. I have read where children said that they heard singing and snuck up there one night only to see Ed with his hands on the stone levitating about 3 foot off the ground, and him singing to the stone and just pushing it like it was weightless, just pushing it across, doing everything that he wanted to do.
Yeah, these are the stories I was talking about.
Yes.
Was he really doing that?
And
can you tell me about his machine? Didn't he have some machine that he had built that he was using? You know what I'm talking about?
Well, they call it like a perpetual magnetic engine or something.
Yeah.
Yes, that's what they call it about. Look, they've only found parts of it. They found it in his writings, in his pamphlets, and they've only found parts of it, like the wheel. There's a certain few things that weren't there. Here's what it looks like, and you and I have discussed this a while back, and this is what it looks like to us. Look, I could talk about all these things about the moon pond. We can talk about what he built, what he cut and carved up there. People had always asked him how he did this, and he just said he simply understood laws of weight and leverage is what he told everybody, and that's how that they understood how to build it, like the Egyptians built the Great Pyramid. That machine you're talking about looks to me almost like it's a machine that you could amplify small electrical charge into a larger electrical charge, something along those lines. What got me to thinking about it was this. I know that they've studied some of those blocks, and they can see saw marks on those blocks, so they know he was cutting them.
Right.
So they're like, well, how would you go about cutting them? And if you knew how to cut them, you know, could you do this? Could you do that? I know what I think happened. I think all those wires and all that's supposed to be magnetic, you know, supposed to make these false magnetic ley lines and all these things here. A lot of that stuff to me looks like a place that you could charge with electricity with this wheel as you created your own electricity, just like a constant flowing current, much like Tesla discussed.
Right.
And then you could just take a tool and loop over it, and then your tool would work almost like a wireless tool, but it's not. You just loop it onto that, kind of like a trolley car does.
Right, I got you.
And then you can use it to drill holes. You can use it to cut stone. You can use it to do anything. Imagine that you could set a saw, kind of like a rip saw for making lumber, on some stone. You got it cutting, and you just walked away.
And
the saw itself would just cut as it just sat there, sawing till it cut the blocks just like you want. You didn't have to do any work. Because when you're a man that's 5 foot tall and 100 pounds, you have to work smarter, not harder.
Right.
So you have to figure out every trick in the book. Now, if you go online, you can see a ton of videos showing guys how they did this and how they did that and how they use fulcrums and all the weight. This is what I have. Now, there's several quality or poor quality photos that you're going to see online of Ed working. Some of them show three giant timbers. It's got look like some pulleys underneath it. And then there's a box up on top, right? You got
yes,
that little magic
box. This is the special box.
Yeah. Basically, it's a tripod. It almost looks like half as tall as utility poles. Here's one thing that you can't find at all. You can't find how Ed got those poles. How'd he even get those? How'd he stand those poles up without help?
Right.
How would you stand up a tripod that size without help? Period. So somebody had to deliver those poles if all he had was a bicycle. So we got some help to get those poles somehow, right?
Yes, sir.
Now you see those pictures of Ed working.
Yep.
Who took the pictures?
Right. Yeah, somebody's
Ed's
videoing it.
Somebody took a picture of Ed working. That's another thing I thought was really, really funny. So you see this, all this stuff on this whole box and this whole deal there. Maybe there was nothing there. Maybe in that box is empty. They always said that was where the magic happened.
Yeah.
Well, it's where the magic happened if you don't know what's in the box. What if it's just there? I mean, who knows what it is? There's no reason to just instantly assume that that's where the magic happens whenever you can see block and tackle hanging from underneath it. You can see it there. So that's, to me, a dead giveaway that, yeah, he knew how they built the pyramids. How they built the pyramids was maybe he could use man-made, very simple mathematics, as he understood. My thing is this. I don't know how well those tripod legs would have held up lifting up those stones. I've never done anything to it, you know. I know when you start talking about crazy weight, I would think, man, it would just break the legs of these giant utility poles or these big poles or whatever that they're having, but maybe they're not. If you've distributed that weight over three legs down into the earth, maybe it can. Now, here's one thing. It doesn't talk about how you move it.
Right.
But if he's got that truck and he's got some sort of wheels, why couldn't he swing it over on something, set it down? Maybe he knows a way. Maybe he's got rails built for it, the whole thing. Now, there are some strange things that has happened besides, you know, who took the photograph of Ed working if nobody saw him working. The strange things, too, are pretty cool about the gate. You remember us talking about?
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. It's a huge stone gate that's perfectly balanced,
yes,
right?
Yes.
You just touch it with your finger and it'll open, even though it weighs like, I don't know, 30 tons or something.
Well, and they had to go back and fix part of that gate. They had to fix the bearing that it set on. And it took like a large group of men and equipment just to fix that gate.
Wow.
But they had to hoist it up to get that thing out of there. And like I said, neighbors had called, had claimed that they had seen him singing to the stones, all this stuff. Young people, and when they say young people, there's a story of like three boys climbed the wall one night, and they said that to them it looked like balloons floating. And it was just Ed pushing blocks around as they were floating. Maybe Ed did know that. Maybe Ed did know the secret to levitation was something magnetic. I don't know. You know, maybe there is more to this story than what we've actually found. Now, he used to believe this. Ed didn't believe contemporary science. This is what he said. All matter consists of magnets, which can produce measurable phenomena and electricity. And he would often say that he rediscovered the laws of weight, measurement, and leverage, and that involved the relationship of the earth to celestial alignments. Now, those quotes are very, very interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because it makes you wonder, is he working during certain alignments and during certain areas? There's always that old wives' tale that if you dig a hole at a certain time of year, you have to use your almanac, that you won't have enough dirt to fill the hole. Now, how crazy is that sound? But it's, you know, you'll dig a hole and you try to fill the hole back in, and it's either got too much dirt or not enough dirt. And they'll always tell you, if you dig at a certain time of year and these certain alignments, that you'll have enough dirt to fill your hole.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so it makes me wonder, hearing that tale, I don't know whether it's true or not. I've never tried it. I've read a lot on it. So I'm looking at this, and I'm reading more about Ed. And to me, I'm not near as interested in the Coral Castle itself as a subject as I am Ed. Ed is a very, very peculiar man, but I don't understand why he's not more looked into. And I'm sure there are people doing it, like Tesla. Ed was apparently onto something, because we don't know how he did it. Like, everybody likes to, like, even I, you know, you kind of almost want to disregard it as a man that maybe he was only using a pulley system, a rope system, and all
right,
that stuff.
Yeah.
But yet nobody's doing it. I don't see anybody else out there jumping up and down to do what Ed was doing and knocking it out.
Well, and they talk about how Ed was, he knew what the ancient Egyptians
yes.
knew. Maybe what he knew was this, you know, perpetual motion holder machine he had. He knew that that's what the Egyptians were using to cut these stone blocks, because, so you were talking about earlier, Christopher Dunn, he's talked about there are tool marks,
mm-hmm.
or it looks like, you know, power tool marks on a lot of the sculptures and stuff in ancient Egypt. So maybe they were using a similar device. Like you're talking about, you just throw your hook on, like the trolley car,
yep.
and you got a power.
There's your power right
a
there.
A powered power tool almost.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what he was talking about when he said he knew what they knew.
Well, there is a theory that Ed was talking about a thing that he called telluric grid dynamics. And basically it's ley lines, magnetic ley lines. Now, Ray Stoner actually wrote a book called The Enigma of Coral Castle. And Ray goes into an idea that a lot of people don't believe, because they believed it was because of either the subdivision or the fact that he was being, you know, had been attacked and mugged and all this stuff. Ray believes that it was because Ed figured out that he'd made an error, that during all of his studies and during all of his work and all this stuff, he realized, I can't build it any bigger right here because I'm in the wrong spot. He messed up his math. And then he went back, redid his mathematics, and decided, oh, hell, I got to move it. So he moved it, and it was actually easier to work on, you know?
Yeah.
And it's because of the way the ley line was in the ground, the magnetics of the ground. I keep saying ley line because I guess I don't have any other way to explain it.
Right.
Other than there's magnetic areas on this planet. Now, he actually, when I say he, I'm talking about Edward. Ed believed in the unified field theory. He actually put a lot into it, and that would explain how he was able to do it. And he identifies himself as an unipolar magnetic particle, which he calls an individual north and south pole magnet, as the prime subatomic carrier of energy. That's the things that he was. So we're getting into physics now, of things that he believed that there was energy, electricity, everything was in magnetism. And that's the reason he had to move it. Now, he provides evidence for this more sound base of understanding that he demonstrated the results of over 50 experiments. And he insists that the implications will impact all branches of science because he thought that they all lacked a sound base.
Wow.
So Ed was one of those very
forward. He's an interesting fellow, isn't he?
Exactly. Very forward thinking, very out there, if you will. Now, and look, if you're listening to this episode and you're thinking, all right, we're going to find to get to the bottom of this. We're not. There's no way of getting to the bottom of this. Ed's dead. Ed's dead, baby. Zed. There's no way of getting to the bottom of this. It's something that we can all look at, but we can all agree on this. Nobody knows how he did it. We've looked and I looked and looked to try to find anything other than singing to stones, magnetic some way, or, you know, block and tackle. Right. Maybe it was a little bit of everything. Maybe Ed sang because he worked by himself at night. I've also heard another subject come up that says the reason he worked by himself at night was because Florida's so damn hot.
Yeah, that would make sense, right?
Makes a lot more sense. It's way cooler to work at night, especially when you're doing all that. Maybe he sang. Maybe he was a bit of a showman also. And maybe he knew whenever people were out there. So he's like, I'll put on a show. I'll have something rigged up to where it looks like I'm doing something that I shouldn't be able to do. You know, maybe I'll build it because if I can make it more enigmatic, then maybe I'll get more people to come see the Coral Castle because he kind of knew this stuff. So maybe there was a little bit of everything. But here's the thing. You can read his work and you can read the things that he said and he believed in. The man was onto something. There's something there that he actually believed. So I don't completely believe that he was like a full-blown showman. I just do believe that he was onto something in some way. Anyway, I love this story. I love the whole thing. There's several books on this whole topic, several videos on this whole topic.
Yeah.
It's fun. This is what I've kind of come to when I looked into this. I was disappointed. And the reason I was disappointed was because I think it was built up more than what it actually really is. I think that there is some answers to it that maybe it's more fun to think it's built with magic than it would be built by somebody that just maybe have understood. Now, I'm not saying that he didn't use magnetism and floated some stones. I'm not saying that, but I'm still saying that if that's what he did, then that's exactly what they've done over the several thousand years when they've created these megaliths.
Stonehenge.
Exactly. Stones, yep. And if that's a fact, then it's really not magic. It's just something we don't quite understand yet. But what's funny to me is that he decided not to share it. So the idea of not sharing it, it's not like you're going to use it to create a weapon. It's one of those things. The idea of not sharing it makes me think that it's not quite as magical as what we were led to believe. But I want to read you this. Ed, actually, this is a quote on education from Ed in 1936. And this is really interesting because I think it really does hit home. It says, you know, we receive an education in the schools from books. All those books that people became educated from 25 years ago are wrong now. And those that are good now will be wrong again in 25 years from now. So if they are wrong then, they are also wrong now. And the one who is educated from the wrong book is not educated. He is misled. All books that are written are wrong. The one who is not educated cannot write a book. And the one who is educated is really not educated, but he is misled. And the one who is misled cannot write a book which is correct. The misleading began when our distant ancestors began to teach their descendants. You know, they knew nothing, but they passed their knowledge of nothing to the coming generations, and it went so innocently that nobody noticed it. That is why we are not educated. Now I will tell you what education is according to my reasoning. An educated person is one whose senses are refined. We are born as brutes. We remain and die as the same if we do not become polished. But all senses do not take polish. Some are coarse to take it. The main base of education is one's self-respect. Anyone lacking self-respect cannot be educated. The main basis of self-respect is the willingness to learn, to do only the things that are good and right, to believe only in the things that can be proved, to possess appreciation and self-control. Now, if you lack willingness to learn, you will remain as a brute. And if you do things that are not good and right, you will be a low person. And if you believe in things that cannot be proved, any feeble-minded person can lead you. And if you lack appreciation, it takes away the incentive for good doing. And if you lack self-control, you will never know the limit. So all those lacking these characteristics in their makeup are not educated. And we are back with Expanded Perspectives, folks. I know I didn't answer any questions, but I hope at least it kind of laid some things out to you and let you think about some things. Like I said, if you're interested in the Coral Castle, please go watch some videos on YouTube, but take everything for a grain of salt. This is like a lot of those crazy stories that we get. It's one of those things that if if he would have passed away in 1991, it might have been different than 1951. It's almost like nobody really knew to befriend this man at the time. Now, sure, he was probably a little odd in the things that was going on, but you know what I mean? It's almost like somebody would have probably done a little better documentation maybe now of what was going on.
If that old man lived down the street from me, that'd be how cool would that be?
Yeah.
I'd go down there with a six-pack and watch old Ed help him out. You need help? All I got is an old man that gets mad if the kids like throw their football over there. Yeah. You know, the grouchy old man down the road.
I know exactly. If they touch his fence,
like,
they go
they're
crazy.
They're 8 years old. They hit a ball into your yard. What's the big deal?
Right.
It's a pasture. Yeah. It's not like it's a well-manicured lawn.
Yeah, right. Ed Leedskellen is building a coral castle, and this old man's just mowing grass.
Yeah.
Like Clint Eastwood, get off my lawn, mean old man. But yeah, anyway, look, I'm still fascinated with this whole subject, and I want to get some of those magnetic field pamphlets that he wrote, read some of his writings, really look into this stuff. I'm fascinated with that kind of physics, the unified theory, all that stuff. It's one of those, it draws me in. But I don't know that the story really is as romantic and full-blown as they claim.
Right.
There's several people. I believe there's a fellow named Scott Russell. I believe that he believes that he solved it, and he's got some really good points. And I mean, he covers some really good stuff. There's some things like that that's out there, but I don't know.
But it makes the story better if you think he was privy to some unknown knowledge, some
it
sacred
does.
Knowledge, ancient technology, alien technology, you know, whatever.
It
makes it sound
does.
A lot cooler than a guy that just was really good with stonemasonry, cutting and carving and moving and pulley systems. That doesn't sound very romantic.
It does. Look, and even the sizes. I could have gone deep into the size of the stone and all these things. But would it be a 28-ton stone? Is that any more impressive than a 2-ton stone? I mean, it's still a huge stone.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that what he created was very impressive. I mean, that's why we're all talking about
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And that there is some air of mystery to it. But you know what I mean? It's like I could go into detail, in immense detail, and give you all the figures of every one of the stones in that whole castle. But it doesn't mean anything. Just because you know the details doesn't mean it's even more or less. To me, if you could move a 2-ton stone with block and pulley, or a 6-ton stone with block and pulley, and then a 28-ton stone, it's still a huge stone. One, you know, I mean, there's a jumping off point where you're like, look, I don't care how big it is, it's still amazing. So, I don't know. It's a very romantic story, and I just feel like maybe it's been romanticized for a reason.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Well, folks, when you listen to us next Monday, we hope to have a crazier show, because this weekend coming up, Kyle and I and Micah Hanks will be road tripping it. If you follow us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, you'll be able to see some pictures. We're going to be road tripping it to Arkansas as we head up to the UFO conference there in Eureka Springs.
Yeah, right.
Or is it called the Ozark Mountain UFO Conference?
Yes, sir.
We're going to be up there. We're going to be up there from Thursday till Sunday. We're going to be running around having some fun. Kyle and I have already looked at the fishing. The fishing's good up there,
too. Oh, yeah,
too.
I'm taking my poles with it.
We're going
for sure,
fishing.
Yeah,
we're going fishing while we're there. But, yeah, we are going to be up there hanging out. If you live around there close, even if you don't want to come to the conference, hit us up on Facebook, hit us up on Twitter, email us, Instagram messages, something. We'll all get together. We'll all go hang out. We'll all get something to eat, get something to drink. We may all go fishing.
Yeah.
Who knows what we'll do? We'll have us some fun. But
I'm excited about it. I mean, I've heard the trout are really biting. So
yes, yeah. And we're going to have, like I said, we're going to take some cameras. We're going to do some videos. We're
going
to try to do some video interviews. We're going to try to get some more people on the show. We're going to have some fun. But like I said, we got to wrap this little dumpling up. We got to go get Micah, Miguel, Josh. We got to go grab a hold of those guys, go fill our bellies, see what they're up to. Now, this Thursday, more than likely, I'm not sure, I'm going to speculate, but if you like to listen to Micah and you listen to on the KGRA network, I'm sure today, on Monday, it's going to be live. His show will be live this evening, and I'm sure Kyle and I will be on it. If we're not, I'm going to be upset because he is going to be in our studio doing it. So
we'll
just hijack his show. That's what we'll do. And then, of course, Thursday, who knows what we're going to be discussing Thursday. I haven't even thought that far in advance. There's too much going on, but I'm sure Mike will be involved in that too. So it'll be like the Graylin X Elite crossover thing again we'll be doing. I don't know why I'm doing the cross like I'm a WWE wrestler. I guess because it's WrestleMania this past week. Anyway, I don't even watch that crap. But anyhow, that's what I'm doing. I'm hitting the X up. Folks, thank you so very much for supporting the show. Thank you so very much for listening and just being along with us on this wild and crazy ride of a podcast that we've been doing. And we're going to try to have some more fun with y'all, like I said, this Thursday. But for sure, jump on there on Facebook, follow the page, follow the Instagram, the whole thing. We're going to be posting pictures, and we're going to have some video for y'all when we get done. We're having a great time.
Don't forget, folks, if you would like to share some stories or news articles with the show, you can email them to expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can call the show 817-945-3828. I hope everybody has a really good week. Don't work too hard. Stay out of trouble. I'm Kyle Filson. He's Kim Hale.
Peace, y'all.